Stanley Clark, and keeping independent radio alive. Donate to KPFK at kpfk.org and do it today.
Hi, this is Gloria Steinem, and you're listening to 90.7 FM KPFK Los Angeles, 112,000 watts of progressive free speech radio.
Welcome to Beneath the Surface. I'm Susie Wiseman. Today, we're going to take you inside the movement that just shook New York City and the political establishment nationwide. Zohra Mamdani's stunning rise from Democratic Socialist Assembly member in Queens to the city's next mayor has exposed both the power of a new multiracial working class politics and the panic that it's unleashed among elites. In the first part of the program, Jacobin's Alex Press will take us out after dark, literally, as Mamdani spends the night talking to nurses, taxi drivers, and delivery workers who keep New York City running while most of the rest of the city is asleep. Her reporting shows what this campaign looks like on the ground, solidarity forged literally in exhaustion and hope. And then in the second half, Jacobin columnist Luke Savage joins me to analyze the backlash, a bipartisan meltdown uniting billionaires, media barons, and party leaders who see in Mamdani's democratic socialism a real threat to the order that they defend. It's a tale of two New Yorks, the one built by workers and the one terrified of them getting power. All this when our program returns in just a moment. And welcome back to Beneath the Surface. I'm Susie Wiseman. And this week, we're looking at the movement that's remaking New York politics. Democratic Socialist mayoral candidate, I guess he's now mayoral-to-be. I forgot what you call that.
Mayor-elect.
Thank you. Zohra Mamdani did something no one expected. He took his campaign to the night shift workers, the taxi drivers, nurses, delivery riders, the people who keep the city alive while the rest of us sleep. Jacobin's Alex Press joined him on that midnight tour, and she brings the story from the streets. Her piece in Jacobin is called Out After Dark with Late Night Workers and Zohra Mamdani. It's really a great piece, and it follows mayoral-elect Zohra Mamdani across Queens on a night shift that reveals what his campaign's really about, the people who make New York City but rarely get heard. And Alex Press has been with us before. I'm always lucky to have her. She's a staff writer at Jacobin covering labor organizing. Her Substack is called The Alex Press, and she's got a forthcoming book, Viking Press, and it's called What We Will. So with all of that, first, congratulations on the book. Congratulations on the article. I love the article.
Thank you so much, Susie.
Thanks. Well, it's a great read. Why don't we just dive right in? I guess the question to begin with is why you chose to follow Mamdani on the night shift campaign. And what did you see that daytime politics miss?
Yeah, I mean, I think one thing to understand about Zohra and working class New Yorkers, especially at the point of the workplace, is that his beginning of his political career, really, as far as when he became a public, even slightly known figure, was when he went on a hunger strike with taxi drivers in New York City. So that was in 2021. And it was a 45-day kind of encampment outside of City Hall that culminated with 15 days of hunger striking. That hunger strike added enough pressure and attention, media attention, solidarity, that they in fact won basically largely the deal they were looking for. So I'll keep it short on this, but this was about the medallion system. So taxi drivers in New York there's a set number of medallions, and taxi drivers often go into a lot of debt to acquire a medallion, and they end up indentured to the person who sold them that medallion in ways that, you know, before this hunger strike and the repackaging of the way this works, some of these drivers owed $200,000, $500,000.
Right.
Enough that in that year, before the hunger strike and things really came to a head, 9 New York taxi drivers committed suicide. And so this is not just a bad job or not enough wages. It was so much debt that, you know, life seemed impossible.
Go
Yes,
ahead,
and
sorry.
Zorn at the time was a new assembly member. You know, he was a DSA member. He was on the left, but this was really right when he started being in office, his first act. And, you know, I think it's really interesting in that every politician, certainly in New York City, says that they're for the workers, right? You have to say you're a pro-union. You know, that's how New York City politics works. I mean, thank goodness, but it doesn't often mean much, right? Zoran, when I was out with him on this shift, on this night shift, you know, the first stop was the LaGuardia Airport parking lot where the taxi drivers queue. And the taxi drivers, some of them stuck with us for all the other stops. And we had a midnight meal at Zoran's favorite kebab place in Jackson Heights in Queens. And I spoke to some of these taxi drivers. And, you know, one of them, Richard Chow, who's quoted in the piece, he had been on the hunger strike with Zoran. And I found out later, you know, at one point, it's not my story to tell, but he remained very close to Zoran and the staff, you know, attending people's weddings. Like, he is very much a core member of this campaign. So seeing this night shift, this canvas that was done, I think the last four, maybe the election was 4 days later. You know, this was really the culmination of the campaign. It was not a photo op. You know, first of all, it was done at midnight, so it really would be hard for it to be a photo op. But these were people that have known Zoran for years, and they see him as their candidate. And so I knew that history with the taxi drivers. So especially when I heard that that was going to be part of the story that night, I was like, this is bringing it full circle, right? Zoran now has become basically a rock star in a kind of shocking way. And yet the campaign has not changed the kind of focus of what the plan is and what the mission is and who the core kind of engines and heart and soul of the campaign are. And that was people like Richard Chow, who also was mentioned by name in Zoran's victory speech on the night of the 4th. So
that's great. And I really like that, because this is really the campaign in a way of the organized working class, and maybe the working class that wants to be organized, but has all of the impediments to getting there.
Yes.
And it's unusual in American politics, and it usually doesn't go very far, but it did in this instance. And I really like the story, because I think you say at one point that Chow is still working 7 days a week. And he's in his 70s, which tells you even more, even though they don't have the medallion system, which I was shocked when I first learned about that, when I first went to New York, you know, that this was just a horrific system. So what you're saying there, though, is that Mamdani's relationship with the workers, and you could probably even take it back to his work in the South Asian Workers Organization, really took that activism and took it into his campaign, so he becomes the candidate. Maybe you could talk a little bit more, because I think when you started the piece, you'd compare the night shift campaign of Mamdani to the night shift optics, I guess.
Eric Adams.
Yeah. But yeah, so say maybe just a word or two about that.
Sure. I mean, Eric Adams, in many ways, kind of has conceptualized himself as mayor as the salesman in chief, right? He's like in certain ways, above all else, the head of the tourism industry, basically. And what that means is he goes out to expensive restaurants and bars and clubs, particularly in Manhattan, and then he mentions those places and he hangs out with celebrities there. And to be clear, that is a version of New York. That is, New York is a place where rich and famous people live and go out. But that is the extent of what Adams sees as nightlife, right? And, you know, it's fun in a way, but the reality is that most New Yorkers are not experiencing New York as a place where you can go out to the club every night. I mean, maybe they work there, but most people do not have that kind of a lifestyle. And it's, I think, to me, kind of telling how that this idea that one might visit workers who stay up late too, as the guy who's the famous out late mayor, that it never seems to have occurred to Adams to do that, I think is a really, it's one of those small things that tells you a lot. Versus, you know, Zoran has also done this visiting clubs and venues thing, though certainly not the expensive ones, because he knows that's part of New York, too. People live here because they like to go out and have fun. But that is not the core. And certainly, you know, I think Zoran, part of the reason for this, and I think part of the story of his victory, is that these types of workers and the communities they hail from and are a part of actually were central to winning the campaign, right? I mean, Zoran comes out of DSA. He certainly has support in what we all have been calling the commie corridor, right? Which is central Brooklyn. It's Bushwick. It's all these places that people like me live, you know, college educated, not necessarily not rich, but often white collar workers. That group cannot win a mayoral election. There is simply too many other types of people in this city. Zoran, fortunately, does not come out just from that demographic, right? These taxi drivers are also people who live in his community. They are, yeah, the South Asian, you know, worker organizing in Queens that he's been a part of. And so this was, I think, is central to both his understanding of what New York City is, and he knew that if he did not take this stuff seriously, you know, if he did not expand his coalition as much as he could from his kind of base to new people that might be brought in by these workers, he couldn't possibly win. So I think it really is central to understand both kind of the vision and the priorities, but also a realistic understanding of who new working class New Yorkers are, where they might be found, and I guess their numbers as well, right? Most people think, oh, these people don't vote. We don't have to focus on them. And I think the Zoran campaign said, well, these are most New Yorkers. So if we can get them to vote, we will win.
It's also interesting because of the shifts, the demographic shifts that we're seeing in the country and the famous white working class that moved to Trump. But that's a different subject. I want to hear more about the night workers. And I think most people think of healthcare workers when they think of night workers, or maybe, you know, not Uber and not so much the taxi drivers. But let's hear about that, because you talk about the Elmhurst Hospital and the public sector crisis. Really, I had to do a double take because I didn't know that the famous SEIU 1199 endorsed Cuomo. So let's hear this whole story about the workers and who they support and how it came together.
Yeah, I think Elmhurst is really worth understanding in its own right. This is the hospital that I would say was the prime spot where COVID began overtaking and overrunning the New York hospitals at the start of the pandemic. I was in New York at the time. It was a terrifying moment, because you'd be hearing ambulances constantly outside of your apartment as you scrolled on the internet and saw these photos of, you know, people are stacked in the hallways. The nurses are wearing the garbage bags to try to make, because they have no protective equipment. You know, it was really an apocalyptic moment. And Elmhurst was where a lot of those photos came from. This is a hospital in Queens that is a public hospital. It is underfunded. It is where a lot of people who get rejected elsewhere are denied medical services, don't have health insurance, they end up at Elmhurst. So this is kind of, I think, in a lot of ways, a perfect vantage point for understanding, you know, why we have someone like Zoran voicing this vision, why it's seen as a crisis, where in other parts of New York City, say Manhattan, it isn't really a crisis going on right now, but it's certainly the city's affordability crisis is a killer, is life and death, if you look at Elmhurst. Yeah, so the stop after LaGuardia was Elmhurst, where we met a bunch of workers who, as you said, you know, all their unions had endorsed Zoran for the general election as the Democratic candidate. Not all of the unions, and in fact, I'd say most unions, either didn't endorse anyone or endorse Cuomo in the primary. Now, I say this in the piece, you know, this might seem crazy to people. I certainly get asked this a lot. Why do unions not support the left-wing candidates in New York? But if you want to boil it down to kind of an easy-to-understand idea, you know, some unions right now see their power as, you know, their members are so disorganized, power is declining, you know, membership is declining, things are getting harder. So the best way to maintain any kind of sway in your city and for your members would be to cultivate relationships with the people who run the city. So for a lot of unions, that meant they had strong relationships with Cuomo, who, again, had been the governor of the state. So they'd known him a long time. And if they could just, you know, it seemed a safe bet. You know, Zoran was not polling well for a very long time. So why not just do him a favor and endorse him, endorse Cuomo, I mean. You know, this is someone that your members already have name recognition. They've never heard of the other guy. And it would take a lot of work to explain the other guy's politics. And, you know, it would be a risky bet. Now, there is another version of union power, of course, one that socialists prefer and think needs to be rebuilt in this country, which would be your power comes from your members' roles on the shop floor. So you could imagine a union that has activated membership, engaged members, is spending money on organizing, is constantly expanding, and in doing so is unleashing this kind of unrest and agitation at the shop floor in whatever industries their workers work in. And that makes them powerful, right? There is always the threat that workers, if they don't get what they want, they might strike or they can speak out. They're very mobilized. That, of course, takes a lot more work. And it's certainly, I mean, easier said than done. So in a way, you understand why a leader looking at the labor movement right now which is, you know, as in a dark place as it's been in 100 years, and saying, well, of
Right.
course, I'm just going to have us pick the guy that's the safe bet. Because the idea of what it would take to pull off the other guy's agenda is simply we're not willing to do that.
But
So,
what a great encapsulation of the crisis of organized labor,
I
you know, in
know.
what you just described,
It's
right?
very
And then
depressing.
but then we should take it to Mamdani because he kind of bridged that and showed, especially in his program, right, of affordability. And I think, you know, we could move into that a bit because Zoran has certainly championed the fight for better working conditions, and that's across the board, you know. And so that's really important. And it wasn't just like we can go into the platform, which I saw in an interview with Bhaskar said could fit on a 3x5 index card. Simple and direct, and of course, important. But I think it was in your article, the quote that Mamdani said he'd be a mayor who stands with the workers at midnight and fights for them at City Hall. So, okay, let's go into that in terms of his platform and from the movement to now having won and will take, you know, office. What does that mean in practice?
Sure, and I think to your point, first of all, about what a broader affordability kind of agenda, were it to pass and be made law, you know, it's not just about workplace rights, though those are a section of what needs to be done. Certainly, I believe that. But you know, I was speaking, for example, I spoke to Peter Lovrick, who is a nurse at Elmhurst. He's worked there for 10 years, and he actually lives in the neighborhood. You know, he sees his patients out on the street, and he said to me, you know, I asked, why do you support Zoran? You know, universal healthcare is not necessarily a big thing that he has been talking about, for example, though I know Peter supports that. And he said, our patients often need more help than the rest, and they usually have fewer resources than the rest. And another first-year medical intern there said, imagine if there were more resources and support for homeless people, like which are as many of their patients. He said, we cannot possibly, you know, these workers are getting the end point of this crisis. What if there were other places helping these people before their issues and health issues got to the point where they ended up in the ER, right? I think they're very obvious, whether it's a higher minimum wage, whether it's more support for homeless people and less policing as a response to the housing crisis, whether there was more housing that was more affordable in the first place. These are all things that actually are earlier stage kind of interventions that a worker in a hospital, you know, the end result might be that they are not having such a barrage of patients that they don't nearly have the staffing to handle. So these things link together, I think, in a real way. And, you know, I will just add one more thing here is one of the workers outside of Elmhurst in OBGYN, her name was Heather. She brought up that she gets Amazon drivers who get UTIs. This is well documented that
Yeah.
particularly women Amazon drivers will hold, they don't have time to go to the bathroom, they don't have access to a bathroom, and they will develop a UTI. And whether it's because they don't have health insurance or they don't have time, it ends up often getting bad enough that they wind up in the hospital. So there are many ways that improving workers, not only working conditions, but living conditions, would have downstream effects for these workers as well. But as you mentioned, you know, there are also questions around labor policy specifically, that Zoran's campaign certainly, I think, had, and in large part, again, because it's workers who have been at the center of the campaign. So their priorities are being heard. You know, I mentioned in the piece, I say, you know, there are many contradictions to come in this mayoralty.
Yep.
One being, what does it mean to be a pro-worker mayor when
Yeah.
unions are almost entirely absent from the private sector, right?
Right.
Zoran cannot decree that workers should organize from on high. And yet, you know, there is going to be a relationship here where someone with Zoran's standing and position can actually use his position to encourage organizing. But it also means that workers at the shop floor are going to have to, you know, act on their own. And Zoran's job also is to remove obstacles for that from them doing so.
Yeah, and I think it's in your piece that he said that he. Well, if the question is, can a mayor make New York City 100% union city? And it sounds, you know, it's not really that out of reality because that was what LaGuardia, the candidate, the earlier mayor, said that he was going to do. We think of San Francisco, used to think of it as a unionized city, parts of LA, unionized cities. But what did he mean by that? And how is that part of the campaign, or let's say his platform now?
Yeah, so the 100% union city is a LaGuardia quote. It's not a Zoran
Yeah.
quote. And LaGuardia did not achieve that, to be clear. He did encourage, with a number of incentives, he encouraged workers to organize and subsidize corporations that were unionized versus not, and encouraged those as preferential places for city contracts, for example. The city contracts with so many companies, so that is another route for encouraging organizing. You know, I think Zoran, his campaign as far as the labor vision, I've mentioned some of it. Other specific questions, I was actually talking to someone about this earlier today who's a tech worker, and I realized that, you know, the key kind of sectors that it seems Zoran has really paid attention to would be gig workers and Amazon workers, and maybe gig workers first and foremost. In this city at this moment, it is remarkable
Important.
how much delivery driving, both the benefits and the costs, has become like a central topic of discussion. It's in the tabloids all the time about how e-bike drivers are constantly running red lights. There's debate over should there be speed limits. Zoran, his answer to all of this, of course, has been those drivers are speeding or are, you know, practicing unsafe measures because they are doing piece rate work and under pressure to go as quickly as possible. You know, these drivers are penalized if they take too long on an order. So it's very obvious that, you know, further penalizing them for doing so won't actually fix the issue. The question is, how do we regulate these gig companies? There's a reason that DoorDash gave the first $1 million donation to a pro Cuomo PAC there, because it's front and center as far as labor issues that Zoran has said we have to regulate these gig companies and stop, you know, sort of being
And
shocked by the outcome.
can this be a citywide thing, or does it have to be through the state?
That is a good question, and one that I think we have to determine. I mean, there are, you can legislate these things at the city level. I mentioned this in the piece, but on the Amazon worker question, you know, Tiffany Caban, who's a left-wing city councilor, has introduced a bill that would require Amazon to directly employ its last-mile delivery drivers. So those drivers are currently third-party subcontractors. They do not directly work for Amazon, even though they show up at your door in an Amazon uniform, driving an Amazon truck, holding your Amazon package. They do not technically have employee status. This is obviously misclassification, one that people like me who have read all the books about Amazon's early years know was an intentional attempt to avoid their workers becoming
Teams.
Teamsters.
Right.
So in a way, these are things like that bill, should it gain traction, Amazon would fight it extremely hard. This is central to Amazon's business model that these not be their employees. But someone like Zoran could, in fact, make a difference here, were he willing to fight on that. So there are things you can do at the city level. And certainly, I think it's a responsibility of the elected officials now when we look at the number of bike e-delivery bike drivers in the city, and something like 60, 70,000 people. I mean,
Wow.
this is a workforce that is completely denied organizing ability and, you know, incredibly low paid, many of them immigrants. I mean, they're facing every crisis in this city possible. And so it's incumbent on Zoran, I think, to actually get serious about what it would look like to change the distribution and organization of their jobs. And I will say, just, you know, on speculation here, Zoran's campaign, Zoran's staff announced the transition team yesterday or 2 days ago. And the chair of it is Lina Khan, who was the head of the Federal Trade Commission. And I would say Amazon's the critic Amazon hates most. So having Lena, I think, lead the transition is a signal that while she does not come out of the labor world, she very much is an antitrust person. I think it's impossible to not think that Amazon will be another company that is like really looked at thoroughly as far as how it is impacting our city and the working class. So to me, that seems obvious as two types of workforces. Of course, there are a million others. I mean, we mentioned healthcare workers. There are so many other workers, but it would be quite significant if those two became front and center as far as what a pro-worker policy looks like.
Right. And this also would be a signal not just for New York City, but for the entire country, because these issues aren't just in New York. They're in every city
Absolutely.
across the country. I was going to ask you, because we talked about LaGuardia, and the other socialist, famous socialist mayor that we all know about is Bernie Sanders, even though the city was nothing like New York City. But is there some sort of, I hate the word blueprint, but some sort of, example model that balances these contradictions that you've been talking about between a radical democratic socialist agenda and the sort of bureaucratic impulses, even from the unions?
Yeah, I mean, that is a question that I don't think we have time to figure out the answer to. I would say that certainly LaGuardia is one figure that Zoran and his team mention a lot. Bernie Sanders, of course, is another one. His mayoral, you know, it's a very different city, Burlington. But I think fundamentally, you don't need a blueprint necessarily to say, like, we have to change the way politics works in the city, and that will mean the same thing, a similar dynamic at the polls and in voting as it does within unions. Like, there is a sense that
Right.
we need to have a real shakeup. And, I would just close by saying that while I understand why these unions did not endorse Zoran in the primary, I think if a union member or a union leader looking seriously and honestly at the state of the labor movement is it is they are rearranging deck chairs on the Titanic as far as tending to shrinking memberships, as the majority of workers have no relation to unions and have no interest in joining. As much as people are pro-union now, it is still something that is a niche benefit in this country. If you ever want to get serious about changing that, now is
Yeah.
the time, and it will take radical change. And so I think admitting that you need something as radically different as a Mamdani administration may be and hopefully will be, this is your moment to do that. And this is what's required. A Cuomo would never be able to achieve this sort of change because it's simply not the vision, nor, everybody who would be in that administration was already preceding over the previous tending to declining membership and benefits. So I think hopefully, my sense is that these unions are very much building relationships with Mamdani and his campaign. And I hope that they allow what their members certainly said at the polls, which is we want things to work differently now.
We've been speaking with Jacobin staff writer Alex Press about her reporting on Zoran Mamdani's night shift campaigning with nurses, taxi drivers, and delivery workers, the people who keep New York going after dark. Alex had to leave us early, but her piece captures the heart of the campaign, solidarity with working people who are usually invisible. We now turn from what's happening on the ground to why the entire political establishment is freaking out about it. Coming up next, Jacobin columnist Luke Savage joins us to zoom out from the street level to the political earthquake Mamdani's campaign has triggered, a bipartisan panic stretching from billionaires and media elites to the Democratic Party leadership. Stay with us. Welcome back to Beneath the Surface. I'm Susie Wiseman and very pleased to have Luke Savage with us again. Luke is a writer, a journalist, an essayist. His work appeared in The Atlantic, The Guardian, The Washington Post, and more, and he's a columnist at Jacobin. His first book, The Dead Center, was published in 2022, and in 2023, he co-authored Searching for Social Democracy: 7 Decades in the Fight for Equality with Ed Broadbent, Frances Abel, and Jonathan Sass, and we talked about that right here. But Luke's new piece in Jacobin is called Zoran Mamdani Provoked a Bipartisan Meltdown. And he uses Rosa Luxemburg's wonderful maxim, socialism or barbarism, as his through line. And in it, he argues that Mamdani's campaign didn't just win an election, it exposed the depth of bipartisan corruption and elite hysteria in U.S. politics. The essay frames Mamdani's New York City mayoral campaign as a moral and political reckoning for America's ruling and political class. And that campaign represented a struggle, as we will hear, for basic dignity, and it was relentlessly denounced by the elites across the spectrum as something sinister and dangerous. So we're going to get Luke's take. And with all of that, Luke, welcome back to the show.
Thanks for having me, Susie. It's good to be back.
It's really great to have you here. And I guess you wrote this on the eve of the election before we knew the result. And then there was that spectacular result. And he didn't just win, he really ran. He really won and left the corrupt Cuomo way behind. So I want to go right into it, but I should just say that in today's newspapers, at least on the front pages, yesterday it was all Mamdani, every inch of the front pages of the LA Times, New York Times, Wall Street Journal, and even the Financial Times. Those are the papers I tend to look at. And today he's not mentioned on the front pages anywhere. And I quickly, switched to the opinion page, and he isn't there either. And I'm thinking, is this now some bipartisan or some campaign that's going to be waged that we gave him too much attention? Now we'll ignore him. What do you think?
Yeah, well, I'm not sure that if you just pretend the mayor of New York City doesn't exist, he'll hear his movement or his program will simply go away. But that does seem to have, that has been the tactic of particularly certain figures within the Democratic Party over the past few months, and we saw it continue even after the results. So, you know, I was struck, if you know, hardly surprised to see figures like Pete Buttigieg and Cory Booker talk endlessly about, you know, gushing about the results in Virginia and places like that. And I mean, no mention at all in, you know, the case of either of those fellows, of Mamdani or of New York City. You know, I guess if the New York election hadn't been happening this week and there'd, you know, been, I don't know, a left-wing victory in a much smaller American city, like if there was a socialist mayor elected in Cleveland or something, that's the kind of thing you might expect, even if you would criticize it. But to kind of take on a cloak of silence around such a significant electoral event is absolutely extraordinary. I hadn't noticed the silence of the papers today, although I imagine that, you know, as soon as Mamdani is in office on January 1st and is starting to implement his program, or trying to, you know, I imagine he'll be making an appearance on, you know, the front page of those papers again pretty soon, especially the Wall Street Journal.
Yeah, exactly. So let's go into your article itself, because it was just, you know, I should say, I smiled when I read it. I just thought it was fantastic. It's in Jacobin, for those of you who want to take a look online at Jacobin Magazine online. And you call the reaction to Mamdani a reverse rainbow coalition, billionaires, party bosses, liberal pundits, and even white supremacists. And the phrase, you know, sort of captures a deep irony, I think, that liberal pluralism collapsed into plutocratic unity. So what does this reveal, do you think, about, I guess, the actual limits, perhaps, of identity politics when class power is threatened?
Let me take a step back for a moment and tell you a story, you know, because the last time I can remember an elite freakout in the United States on anything like the scale was, of course, in 2020, you know, just ahead of Super Tuesday. And it was actually just a few days before Super Tuesday that I myself attended a Bernie Sanders rally for the very first time. And obviously, we've been hearing for years, we'd heard since 2016 that, you know, from the usual suspects that the Bernie Sanders movement was, you know, it was so negative. It was dangerous. It was primarily driven by, I don't know, white male resentment, whatever else. You know, the Clinton campaign kind of started that narrative, and kind of Democrats in various ways continued to run with it. And it's not as if I expected to find that story about Sanders and his movement vindicated when I arrived at Boston Common, which is where the rally was, I guess it must have been very late February or early March of 2020. But I mean, what I saw, which was the most, you know, youthful and hopeful crowd, who were, you know, all the applause lines were about peace and wanting a better world and that kind of thing. I mean, just the most earnest calls for social and economic justice you can imagine. And I think back to that day quite a lot, because you know, the elite freakout about Sanders always seemed so totally absurd to me. Now, obviously, given that, you know, Sanders was, among other things, campaigning on nationalizing health insurance, you can understand the financial interests, at least, and, you know, the advertise on big networks and so on, and in major newspapers. You can understand their resolute hostility to Sanders. The same hostility to Mamdani, and in some ways, I think, it was a worse hostility because it, you know, it came with this really ugly tinge of racism as well. Mm-hmm. You know, when we step back and we, you know, kind of consider the scale of what, you know, Mamdani is proposing to do, I mean, it really is even more extraordinary. And of course, I'm not saying that the mayor of New York City is not important or that this program is not important. But, you know, in the main, what we're talking about here are things like free bus service, right? Which the MTA in New York already says that half of fares go unpaid. So this is really just, you know, this is really just officializing that and extending it for the other 50%. You know, we're talking about universal childcare. Doesn't sound that scary to me. We're talking about the creation of 5 publicly owned grocery stores that will operate on a not-for-profit basis. You know, hopefully if that works, that'll be expanded. But it's not like Mamdani is planning to expropriate every bodega and supermarket, right? I mean, he's talking about raising the minimum wage in New York City to $30 an hour by 2030. I mean, I don't know what that would be if you adjusted it for inflation, you know, in real dollars. But again, it's a very common sense measure that, you know, is about no more or less than making, you know, one of the richest cities in the world a bit less arduous for most of the people who live in it to live in. That's it. And so the scale of what we've seen, which I don't expect any of this to kind of ratchet down. If anything, I think it'll ratchet up, particularly after January 1st. I think it's worth keeping in perspective the relative modesty of, you know, everything I just outlined, given the extent of what we've seen and how ugly it's been.
Well, I think I want to go into that, but just a comment. Back in the 70s, when I lived in Britain, there was an actual discussion about London transport, which is extremely expensive. And they said that if we made the tube free, it would actually be cheaper. And it would be cheaper, obviously, because you didn't need to employ so many people making sure that others pay. And then the argument boiled down to, well, yeah, that would be fair for Londoners, but there's so many tourists. Why should they get to do it for free? You know? And you can see how all of these issues, you know, even when they make sense in under capitalism, provoke all of these other sort of chauvinist tendencies. But anyway, let's go back to the program, because, and also just the reaction, because it was across the board. And you talk about that. And I wanted to, you know, just get your comment on what a lightning rod Mamdani's campaign became for the other side. And it's funny because for the last longest time, we've been living in a class war. It's just that it's been waged by the other side. And now all of a sudden, you see that how they react, you know, when they get class politics from our side, let's say.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, I think that in addition to everything I just outlined, which is the actual program, and, you know, there's things that in that program that plutocrats don't like because it's going to be financed, or the plan is to have it financed through, again, fairly modest tax increases on the wealthiest New Yorkers, you know, income tax increases, and also an increase in the corporate tax, I believe by 2%, which is something Mamdani has talked about. Again, that's pretty modest, but I think the real threat as these people see it, and I think this is what really accounts for the shrillness and the scale of the reaction we've seen, the real threat is that somebody like this can succeed at all, that they can succeed electorally. You know, it's possible to win on this kind of a program. It's possible to run on this kind of a program and then implement it. Because if people see that that's the case, right, all bets are off. You know, if you can actually do this stuff, you know, people will probably start demanding more of it. They'll start demanding it in other places where, you know, it's like not as if the plutocrats who, you know, inhabit New York, it's not as if they're, you know, the things they own and control are limited to New York, right? They're all over the place. And if people start demanding this kind of thing all over the place, again, even if what they're demanding is just free bus service and a slightly higher minimum wage, you know, that could be catastrophic. I think that's really what's explained the reaction. I think from within the political class itself, particularly within the upper echelons of the Democratic Party, you know, they don't want competition from within either, right? They don't want people to see that there is an alternative to the kind of politics they favor. Or if there is, they, you know, the alternative they want is like an ersatz one. It's represented by, you know, they just want to be thinking about Abigail Spanberger or whatever.
Right. And this is exactly the point, because there is this, it's not tension. It's open, you know, rivalry within the Democratic Party. And a lot of people try to portray it as generational, but it's political. And what you have, of course, are the old style corporate Democrats who are beholden to the donors. And maybe it's the youngers, but there's also younger generation who are demanding change. But it's also, there have always been others within the Democratic Party who see themselves as more, you know, lukewarm social Democrats, but who want to see, you know, more goods for everyone. And of course, you know, it's been played out in the last, two decades. And the corporate Democrats have been in power. Now they're reviled for the most part. But and what you saw in terms, I think you pointed out, in the Mamdani campaign was that there was consensus, and it wasn't just from the right, but also within the Democratic Party. So from New York Times to Fox News, you have Schumer, Jeffries, Gillibrand, and even the Times editorial board. I shouldn't say even, I should just say, and the Times editorial board, all deploying the language of hysteria. And they frame Mamdani as dangerous. They also use Islamophobic and, you know, social and Cold War epithets. So, and it's, I kind of want to ask you, it's perhaps silly, but, you know, what do you think is more dangerous about Mamdani, that he's a socialist or that he's a Muslim or an immigrant, or is it all of that put together?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's really all of the above. And I haven't seen this as much from liberals, but certainly on the right, there's been a bit of resurgence of those really, those kind of ugly formulations of a kind we used to see, you know, in the years after 9/11 during the war on terror, you know, I've seen a lot of Trump people talk in terms of, you know, Islamo-Bolshevism, you know, Islamic communism, this kind of thing. And, you know, it's easy to laugh at that. And I do, and we should. But, you know, there is something really deeply sinister about that as well, right? Because the combination of, you know, sort of ethnic and ideological chauvinisms that's happening there, which I think in a very real way does echo, does echo the example of anti-Semitism in the 20th century, you know, similar kinds of formulations in the 1930s.
And it's really brought it up. As you were speaking, I was thinking about the Cold War sort of aspect of it, because you mentioned all these different things like Islamo-communism, Islamo-Bolshevism. I don't think I heard that one. But we did hear a lot after 9/11 of Islamo-fascism. And now that's sort of receded, I guess. And what you see here is maybe it's a continuity or just an aspect of, and that is between anti-communism and Islamophobia, because the two, especially, you know, from the Cold War until now, have been the alternative religions or items of faith, you know, in terms, articles of faith, I should say, in the U.S., that you define yourself as opposed to that. How do you see that? And do you think that this campaign accentuated that in its reaction, or it helps transcend that sort of prejudice?
Well, I think the Cold War tendency that you just described is part of the deep structure of the bipartisan establishment in the United States. And actually, you know, you mentioned my book, The Dead Center, off the top. In that book, you know, I slightly regret that I didn't pay more attention to the Cold War as, you know, something that continues to inform, even unconsciously, a lot of the worst tendencies of the so-called political center. You know, just a few weeks ago, actually, when Kamala Harris was being interviewed, I thought it was very striking when she referred to she was on Rachel Maddow, I believe, and she referred to Donald Trump as a tyrant and a communist dictator. And now that is not the first time we've seen, a major figure within the Democratic Party, assert, you know, kind of try to attach a Marxist or a communist lineage to Donald Trump. We saw that a lot after 2016 in the kind of Russiagate panic. Cass Sunstein, another example, he, you know, one of the major kind of intellectuals of the early Obama presidency. He was he had a great piece, great in scare quotes there, from 2017. Russia is using Marxist strategies and so is Trump. However dumb you think that is hearing that headline, I assure you it's even dumber. But it's
breathtaking in its ignorance, and that it would come from somebody that high up in the political class who should know better, you know. And I'm just stunned. I had not heard that he was called a communist dictator. But, you know, just as a little side, it does explain, you know, sort of this attitude that, you know, Russia continues to be the enemy, whether it's so-called communist, because it never really was. Or it's, you know, this form of authoritarian capitalism. It doesn't matter.
That's right. I mean, it doesn't make rational sense, but, you know, the circle completes itself, you know, with the other half of this, I suppose, probably a mixed metaphor, but you know what I mean? Because, you know, the other half of it is that, you know, this is like, this is always framed as a binary fight against tyranny. You know, that you have the forces of freedom and democracy that are represented by, you know, centrist, corporate friendly liberalism. And then you have everything else. And the everything else includes Donald Trump and MAGA, but it also includes the Sanders movement, includes, you know, democratic socialists. It includes, you know, mild social democracy. It includes anyone who, you know, wants things to be even slightly better, wants political expectations to be raised. I think the self-conception of much of the American ruling class today, especially, and I mean this in a bipartisan sense, really is like we are holding back the forces of tyranny, whether they come from the left or the right. And those things are kind of morally and politically equivalent. So I think all of that has very much been operating behind the scenes in the Mamdani freakout as well, you know, albeit with this particularly ugly tinge of racism attached to it.
Right. Well, one thing that, you know, I said at the top was that your through line in this article is socialism or barbarism. That's a binary, as you're talking about it. But this is Rosa Luxemburg's phrase, and you resurrect it as more than metaphor. And how do you see the campaign illustrating that we're at this kind of crossroads between, let's say, democratic renewal and authoritarian decline?
I mean, it was so perfect, not only because of what Mamdani himself embodied and does embody, but because of what what he was facing, and because of who his opponent was, right? I mean, Andrew Cuomo is about as abhorrent and morally repellent a political figure as you could possibly imagine. And yet, you know, this wasn't just in the general, you know, going back to the primary, he was being endorsed by people who'd called on him to resign just a few years earlier. Right. You know, I believe he was endorsed by Kirsten Gillibrand, you know, for example, right. by a lot of these people.
Hypocrisy, right? For Kirsten Gillibrand, who,
I mean, exactly. I mean, you have
Me Too campaign, right?
Exactly. And so here you have this, dynastic politician, who has a walking stack of sexual harassment lawsuits, you know, famously corrupt figure, had to resign for that reason as well. I mean, just the worst kind of, ugly machine politics you could possibly imagine. And, you know, Andrew Cuomo found ways to outdo himself because, I mean, particularly in the general election when he decided to run as an independent, I didn't really think his campaign could sink any lower than it already had. But I mean, some of the ugly stuff, you know, there was an interview just a few weeks ago, I think, where he was talking to some right-wing host who was musing about how, I think first it was, you know, Mamdani, imagine if there was another 9/11 and Mamdani was mayor and Cuomo agreed with that. And then they took it even further and said, well, of course he'd also be celebrating. And Cuomo said, yeah, well, there's that too.
And then there was Gillibrand's statement about the global jihad. It's just part of the same hysteria and racism.
That's right. I mean, it's so ugly. And I just thought that you know, in light of that fact, that the choice really could not be any starker. It was so clear that this is a confrontation in a very real sense between the good guys and the bad guys insofar as those categories exist. One of the reasons I was so pleased about the outcome.
Right. Well, and then, but on the other side of it, you know, when Mamdani did not recoil from any of these attacks, and he was, you know, on message all the time. And his, I think I read somewhere else that his platform could be on a little 3x5 index card, and he just stuck to it on affordability. But he also, you know, had this, and you write about this, Luke Savage, that the movement and the campaign were joyous, vibrant, and hopeful. And it raises the question about just how subversive joy is, you know, and that especially in a political culture that's built on cynicism and fear. So do you see this as a political defiance or some kind of, you know, way that we should all aspire to be?
Well, you know, normally I'd be pretty hesitant just by reflex to, you know, talk about a politics of joy or something like that.
Oops, you know, I forgot about Kamala Harris's campaign.
Right. That's right. She did use that. She did that, yeah. Use that expression. But, you know, politics of joy or anything else like that. You know, I think usually when, you know, people speak in those terms, they're talking about, you know, a politics of spectacle. They're talking about, you know, they're trying to substitute affectation for ideology, affectation for program. That's not what Mamdani was trying to do at all. That's not what he was doing. You know, I think his, you know, the positivity of his campaign reflected the very genuine belief on his part and on the part of everyone involved that, you know, this was a cause worth fighting for. You know, there's a great article in Jacobin, I believe, last month by the organizer Waleed Shaheed. And I actually just want to quote from it here because I think he nails this really well. He says, where others narrate decline, Mamdani sees a place worth fixing. This is what Democrats too often miss. A politics built only around fear or opposition cannot inspire. It can only react and manage. What's needed is a politics that treats people not as victims of crisis, but as co-authors of what can still be repaired and built. Mamdani unsettles that picture because he seems to operate by a different logic than the party around him. To consultants, he looks like a curiosity, a young democratic socialist with TikTok fluency and diasporic ease, part of a new class of politicians who seem born to go viral. But what sets him apart isn't novelty, it's conviction. I think that puts it really beautifully. And
I do too. And I should just say that in your article too, you say, you know, with grit and grace, you use those two qualifiers about his campaign, but also discipline. And the discipline is also from the organizers and this gigantic force. And I should just tell the listeners that next week I'm interviewing, it's going to be a panel discussion from many of the organizing groups that will talk about what happened and how they did it. But this is really important because now we have to see now that he's elected, that Mamdani is elected with an incredibly popular program, but as you say, you know, bipartisan panic and hysteria. And there was a lot of money that went into the campaign to defeat him from the billionaires. So in a way, I wonder what you think about his victory beyond electoral power. Is this something that will try to be replicated elsewhere, or, you know, is at least, I don't know. How do you feel about that?
Well, in terms of the campaign, everybody needs to study this and figure out as much as possible about how exactly they did this, because it was a totally long shot campaign. And, you know, the combination, as you said, between, you know, just really relentless discipline of message and so much else, on the one hand, but also just the kind of spontaneity of everything, the authenticity, which really wasn't a put on. It felt incredibly real because it was. And I think that's one of the things, that's one of the other things that made people so enthusiastic and kind of, you know, kept them there once they'd been hooked. I mean, you know, we haven't even talked about Mamdani's videos, but I mean, absolutely extraordinary stuff. So all of that needs to be studied very, very closely. I mean, in terms of what happens now, I mean, it's only been a few days since the election. I think the early signs are certainly encouraging. You know, I saw Mamdani appointing Lina Khan and a few others to his to chair his transition. I think that's a very good sign. You know, Lina Khan, obviously a good example of a public figure with a lot of experience and good politics and good instincts as well. You know, I also saw that Mamdani is setting up some kind of a side organization. I'm already forgetting the name, but kind of doing the exact opposite to what Barack Obama did after 2008, where, you know, right. Obama for America was ostensibly going to be this big, you know, organizing arm that was going to organize for the president's agenda. It was essentially mothballed. It was dismantled. It was turned into the world's, you know, most expensive listserv. And Mamdani does not seem like, that does not seem to be the direction where this is headed. I mean, it'll be interesting to see what this organization does and how it's used. But the fact that they are trying to set up something like that at all, I think is, you know, that clues us into the fact that they're aware of the forces they're going to be up against and what it's going to take to overcome them.
I think that's absolutely right. And we're probably going to have to end it there. But there was not just this gigantic movement that coalesced around Obama with hope and expectation and also joy, but then utter frustration afterwards when they were basically told to go home and they wanted to go out all across the country and you know, campaign for universal health care and all kinds of other things. And if you look at Mamdani's campaign, it was just the opposite. It wasn't about his story. It was about people and their stories and their needs and the crisis of affordability. And that's something that he knows he couldn't have done without all that organizing that he did and that others did to make sure that this victory was possible. So I guess, you know, it at the end of your article, you go back to sometimes it's just really about socialism or barbarism. And maybe that is what creates such a panic. Is that your final thought?
Yeah, I think so. I think this was a binary choice, and the right side of the binary prevailed, and hopefully it will continue to do so, because I think if it does, this kind of thing is infectious, and it tends to spread elsewhere, and we should be hopeful that it will.
Thanks for being with us, Luke Saffage, and thanks for writing this terrific article in Jacobin called Zoran Mamdani Provoked a Bipartisan Meltdown. You can go online to Jacobin and find it. And Luke has been on the show before to talk about, along with Francis Abel and Jonathan Sass, about the book with Ed Broadbent, Searching for Social Democracy, 7 Decades in the Fight for Equality. More to the point, I guess, is his first book, The Dead Center, which maybe you'll want to revisit and revise at some, I don't know, done in 2022. And Luke is a columnist for Jacobin and writes in other places as well. Thanks for joining us today, Luke.
A pleasure as always. Cheers.
And that's our show for today. I'd like to thank my guests, Alex Press and Luke Saffage. Thanks to executive producer Robert Brenner, producer-director Melissa Figueroa, editor-engineer Juliana Gota, and Aussie Flamenco in Master Control. You can listen to this and our other archive shows at kpfk.org. Click Audio Archives and scroll down to Beneath the Surface with Susie Wiseman. You'll find more information on our programs and guests on our Facebook page, and that's Beneath the Surface with Susie Wiseman. You can also listen to an extended version of this program on Jacobin Radio, available wherever you listen to your podcasts. And you've been listening to Beneath the Surface on KPFK, Pacifica Radio, for all of Southern California and beyond, streaming live and archived at kpfk.org. Thanks for listening, and thanks for your support. Stay tuned now for Ian Masters and Background Briefing. I'm Susie Wiseman.
KPFK's future depends on listener support in all shapes and sizes. One of the many ways that you can make a long-term impact is by donating land or business properties that you no longer need. Learn more about the advantages of donating real estate to secure KPFK's future. More information is at kpfk.org.
I'm Chuck Foster. Join me at 2 p.m. Sundays for Reggae Central, playing ska, rock steady, roots, dub, and dancehall. New releases, old favorites, and delightful obscurities right here on KPFK 90.7 FM in L.A.
The benefits of donating your used vehicle to KPFK include funding new and existing programming, as well as increasing community awareness. You also benefit by being able to reduce your taxable income. There's no need to deal with the hassles of selling it, and you support public radio in the process. To donate your vehicle, please call 877-KPFK-AUTO. That's 877-KPFK-AUTO.
KPFK invites you to tune into The Global Village, weekdays from 11 a.m. to 1 p.m., bringing you a global mix of hosts seeking the universal soul and making musical connections between our geographical and musical cultures. That's The Global Village, KPFK's flagship music program, with new and familiar voices, Monday through Friday from 11 a.m. to 1 p.m., right here on 90.7 FM and online at kpfk.org.
ICE is escalating deportation operations around the Los Angeles area. But if you are stopped by ICE officers, you have constitutional rights, regardless of your immigration status. If you or someone you know has been detained or wants to report ICE, more information is available at CIRLA at 888-624-4752 for legal help and resources. It is bilingual. More information at CHIRLA.